One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well. Back again, are we? Good. I was beginning to think some of you might have had your fill after last week's stories. But here you are, drawn back to the fire, as if some part of you needs to hear more. Maybe it's curiosity. Maybe it's something else. Maybe you just started to feel it. That creeping sensation that the stories we tell here don't stay buried in the firelight, that they linger, waiting, just beyond the edge of the dark. Last time we talked about legends with teeth, didn't we? Things that hunt and bite and make sure you don't walk home alone at night. But tonight, the things in these stories, well, they don't just stalk, they don't just hunt. They do something worse. They watch. They wait. They whisper. And the best part? Tonight's tales come from a man who knows a thing or two about whispers in the dark. Both of these stories were written by Jeffrey Ebright, and let me tell you, he's got a knack for spinning a yarn that lingers in the back of your mind long after you've heard it. So get comfortable, but not too comfortable, because our first tale tonight, it's about shadows, not the kind you think you know, not the ones that vanish when the lights come on. No, these ones, they stay with you. They follow you. This is Parliament of Shades, written by Jeffrey Ebright. In the ruins of a long-abandoned mill, Emma Reardon grasped the fleeting strands of sanity that remained, trying not to succumb to the horror surrounding her. Remembering how all this had begun, Emma recalled opting out of higher education in England. She decided to journey across the pond to the United States to study anthropology at the much-touted Miskatonic University in Essex County, Massachusetts. The air of old New England aristocracy was very much like her hometown of West Wycombe. This climate made her comfortable in her new campus life. Upon her first midterm in higher education, Emma and her small band of friends decided to celebrate with a pub crawl. Unfortunately, the closest city, Arkham, was not a typical college party venue, but it did have a half-dozen pubs. Emma was a bit apprehensive about the night of drinking. In her 20 years, she had never done a drug more powerful than aspirin. Alcohol had certainly never touched her lips. She really didn't want to make an ass out of herself. "Em, don't worry about it. I'll even volunteer for hair-holding duty," Claire, her dorm roommate, promised. "Ex ignorantia ad sapientium, ex lus ad tenebris," Emma and her four classmates roared. It was the third time they'd proclaimed the university motto in as many bars when Emma began to feel the compounding effects of the alcohol on her brain. "You okay, Emma?" asked Charles, a maid who was clearly enamored with Emma. "You're looking a little pale," added Claire. Emma flashed her soft green eyes at them. "I just need a spot of air." Outside the tavern, she slowly drew in the crisp fall air, but the alcohol was still playing on her balance and focus. Her stomach started to churn, and she feared a liquor-inspired purge, and she held herself up against the cold stones of the building as she made her way to the small alley behind the tavern. "A tone." A low, masculine voice rumbled in her ears like a distant peal of thunder. A terrible velvet hand clutched her heart. A figure composed of the darkest shadows stood in the alley. The 6-foot form rippled like an image caught between the tuning of a television, yet never lost substance. She could make out the contour of a knee-length coat and a proper English bowler hat. "Stay away." Emma barely slurred, but the shadow man advanced. "Em, everything all?" Charles had come up from the tavern to check on his crush. "Help me," she sputtered and pointed down the alley. Charles puffed his chest and pointed an accusing finger. "Back off, creep."
"A tone,"
the shadow said, ignoring the young man's command.
"No," Emma shrieked.
The events that played out before her were not alcohol-induced hallucinations. Unbridled terror ensured Emma witnessed every detail with stark clarity, as if she were helplessly detached and floating above the confrontation. Charles was in the middle of asserting his dominance when his words choked off. She could hear his labored, panicked breathing as his feet began to leave the ground. An indescribable rigor mortis gripped his thin frame as his body continued to elevate off the brick alley pavement. The shadow man halted his progress. It was then that Charles' head began to shake, imperceptibly at first, then more violently. It was as if his head had been placed in a paint can shaker, and the speed was being methodically increased.
"Stop it! Leave him alone!" Emma pleaded.
A sharp, brittle crack sounded from Charles' neck. He fell to the bricks like a wet, discarded towel. Emma, tears cascading down her face, issued a scream of pure torment. This brought a steady, concerned stream of patrons from the tavern. But Emma's eyes didn't leave the ominous shadow man. As the patrons attended to her and the lifeless body of her schoolmate, the figure slowly receded into the blackness of the alley.
"There!"
Emma pointed down the alley. Some of the crowd, members of the Miskatonic University lacrosse team, thundered down the alley with murderous intent, only to return with puzzled expressions and explanations of the dead end the alley had become. This overwhelmed Emma into unconsciousness. Emma had no idea how long she'd been unconscious, but the beeping of a heart monitor made it immediately clear she was in a hospital. The somber glow of the machines competed with the dull overhead fluorescent light above her bed as her eyes fought to focus on the green numbers of the digital clock on the wall. It was 2:47, almost 4 hours past the time she had last remembered. "Welcome back, sweetie." She noticed the physician assistant sitting in a chair who'd taken her eyes from the paperback book. "You're in Arkham Hospital. You're okay."
Am I?" she wondered.
She looked at the wires running down her gown and the IV in her arm. "You'll be out of here in the morning.
The PA gave a practiced smile. Can you recall what happened?
No,
Emma lied, remembering every grisly detail of the nightmare that had unfolded in the alley. Within minutes, she drifted back to dreamless sleep. Claire greeted her in the morning with a smile and Emma's drink of coffee, a double mocha latte. Her roommate made a point to avoid any conversation concerning the previous night's events, and that was fine by Emma.
Your mom called, Claire finally managed to say during the drive back to the campus.
What'd she say? A different wave of nausea hit her.
The university called her, she shrugged.
Emma rested her head on the dash.
What'd you say?
I said it was a slight case of food poisoning. Hospital was keeping you overnight. No biggie. I told her you'd call her.
Bollocks, Emma sighed.
After we stop off and pick up your prescription, you're going to call your mama. No excuses. Emma waited in the car while Claire dashed into the pharmacy. The effects of the alcohol were burning out of her system, and she tried to stem the tide of her heavily caffeinated beverage.
Okay, Claire said, startling Emma upon her return several minutes later.
She shook the small white bag and plopped it into the driver's seat.
What is it?
Emma took the bag, clearly distracted. Trazodone, Claire said as she keyed the ignition. My dad used to take it for his insomnia. It helped with his anxiety, too. He said it worked great with a couple of beers.
I don't see myself drinking any time soon.
Listen, Em. Claire looked at her with concerned eyes. Last night was messed up. I can't imagine what happened, but I wouldn't be surprised if you feel a little sleepless and anxious. If you need to take a pill, take one. She popped a smile and a wink. You're a lightweight anyway. You can always share. As Claire promised, Emma called home when they returned to the dorm. Emma stuck to Claire's carefully crafted cover story. Mother used her very concerned voice as she made Emma promise no drugs or alcohol. Emma swore she would study and make her mother proud. It took no time for Emma to hang up the phone, open the little brown pharmacy bottle, and swallow a trazodone. In the warm orange light of the afternoon sun, Emma drifted off into a sleep without nightmares. However, she did dream. She awakened to the night and the smell of spicy ramen noodles. Claire noticed Emma sitting up and offering her a steaming bowl. She accepted, and the two sat in their dormitory, eating ramen in silence for a time.
Did I ever talk about my hometown? Emma asked.
Not really. Claire finished a particularly long strand of noodles. I know it's in England, she giggled. Emma smiled. I was born and raised in West Wycombe, Buckinghamshire, just north of London. One of the reasons I decided on anthropology as my field of study was our major tourist attraction. Have you ever heard of the Hellfire Caves?
No.
I'm not surprised. The only people who recognize the name are people who follow the paranormal. The caves were built in the mid-1700s by Baron Le Despencer and Francis Dashwood. He was the founder of several exclusive male clubs. The Hellfire Club was one of his more notorious creations.
He built caves?
Why? No one knows, really. That's part of his controversial legacy. He constructed a series of tunnels and chambers that ran 500 meters underground, about a quarter mile, for unknown rituals and parties. As always rumored, the men of the club took the motto, "Do what thou wilt," to perverse extremes. When I was growing up in West Wycombe, it was simply part of the town's spotty legend. The caves were shut down until the 1950s, when the 11th Baronet decided to refurbish them and open them up to the public for much-needed funds. Yeah, make money where you can. Claire had abandoned her noodles and listened intently.
True.
The Hellfire Caves had been the main economy for West Wycombe. The cottage industry, if you will. Growing up there, every maid old enough to ride a pushbike explored the caves. I was no exception.
Is that what you were dreaming about?
Emma nodded. I was 10 years old when I first explored the Hellfire Caves. My mom decided to take my older sister Debbie and me through the caves.
Back then, there was a tourist and a local tour. The local tour had no tour guide because locals should know the history of their own landmarks and wouldn't need the boring narration of a guide. Plus, it was a pound cheaper. The tunnels were constructed of a bizarre mix of influences, including Italian, Ottoman, Turkish, and a few other architectural designs. There was probably a plan when excavation started, but it ended up a mishmash by the time they finished the tunnels. The only constant was the pagan god statues that popped up in larger bins in some of the chambers.
Pagan? Like druid?
More a mix of Greek and Roman pantheons, especially Bacchus and Venus.
Gods of liquor and sex?
Sounds like an old boys' club to me. Claire laughed.
Undoubtedly.
I dreamed my sister and I were playing hide-and-seek in the caves. Debbie did the hiding, but I couldn't find her. I searched for what seemed like hours, but she had vanished. I sat down in one of the rooms and started crying.
Oh, poor Em.
Claire added with concerned sarcasm. A girl, maybe in her mid-teens, appeared in a long white Victorian-era dress. Without a word, she offered me her hand. I took her hand. She smiled and led me from the chamber to an exit next to St. Lawrence Church. Emma said, as if stopping a joke before the punchline.
And?
First, there is no cave exit next to the church. The church sits in the caves, in the center of the tunnel network. Baron Dashwood designed a church to sit directly above the main banquet chamber. He believed it a physical representation of heaven and hell. Second, the girl in white was gone when I looked back toward the entrance. I believe that was Suki. Let me guess. A ghost, right? Spot on. Legend says the ghost of an attractive chambermaid named Suki roams the surrounding land and tunnels of the Hellfire Caves. She died as a result of some local boy she had spurned. Suki longed for an aristocratic life. The boy sent her a message under the guise of her true love, a young affluent aristocrat. The note asked her to dress in her finest white gown and meet him at the caves. When she arrived, she discovered it was all a cruel hoax. She cursed and yelled at them as they openly mocked her. Suki became so enraged she started throwing rocks at her tormentors. One of the boys was struck, and he retaliated. And keep in mind, most of these boys were forged by working in the chalk mines, so they were not weak chaps. In any event, his rock struck her and knocked her down. When they didn't see her moving, they investigated and realized she'd fallen hard on the cobblestone and was bleeding profusely from her head. By the time the boys got her back to town proper, it was too late. She died. And now her ghost haunts the caves. Claire offered it more as a conclusion than a question. Correct. Emma finished her ramen and set the bowl on her nightstand. There's an unsettling thing about that dream. You know how there's a misty quality to dreaming? This felt real, like a memory. Are you saying you remembered being rescued by a ghost when you were a kid?
I don't know what I'm saying.
Emma shrugged. It's knocked me off a bit, off my pins.
I understand, Claire put her hand on her shoulder. How about I go get us a snack and we can do something girly like braid hair and talk about cute college boys?
There's a full class schedule I have to attend to, Claire.
Oh, that's right.
Claire slapped her forehead. I forgot to tell you. All classes have been canceled for the next couple of days because of last night. She regrouped. The next class we have is the field trip on Saturday. Emma tried not to picture Charles and the horrific snapping of his neck. Still, we must carry on, and I could use a bag of crisps.
Your wish is my command.
Claire swallowed herself in a pink terry cloth robe with a pattern of little black terriers dancing. I'll hit the vending machines and be right back. Once Claire was out the door, Emma quickly downed a couple of trazodone with some water and waited for them to take effect. She was mildly loopy by the time Claire returned from the vending machines with two dark chocolate Milky Ways, a bag of cheddar and sour cream chips, Claire's favorite, a bag of salt and vinegar chips, Emma's favorite, and two cans of Monster Java. FYI, there are still grief counselors roaming the hall, You might want to stay in for the night, Claire said between crunches. I told my mom I'd Skype her tonight. Emma shook her head, half in protest of the confinement, half as a test of her sobriety. She felt the latter was fine. She picked up her laptop bag and started out the door. I'll be back soon. Perhaps the worst part of dorm life was the lack of readily accessible technology on campus. The hallowed halls of the university were thick stone walls built more than an eventual siege than an educational resource. This meant Wi-Fi in dorm rooms were, at best, spotty. Any student needing a strong connection would be forced to make the trip to one of the common areas conveniently located on each floor. Unfortunately, Emma's walk had begun to disprove her pill tolerance. She slowed her gait to retain control as she placed a computer bag on a common table. With the exception of a professionally dressed woman packing papers into a leather satchel, on the other side of the room, the common room was deserted. Before she fired up her Skype account, Emma decided to try a hunch on Google Images. She typed the words Shadowmen Bowler Derby Hat into the search box. She scrolled to the sixth row and caught her breath. Mixed among the plethora of single hat pics, she found a faded image which she immediately clicked. It was a black and white photo taken in some dilapidated place. It was not the hangman's noose that struck her cold, but the four men in the photo, featureless silhouettes all wearing bowlers. The abbreviated blurb under the website signature read, "The Parliament of Shades." She took another deep breath and clicked Visit Page. The picture had been archived on a website called Historical Paranormal UK. The short article was titled, "England's Men in Black." Emma, now feeling the effects of the pills, concentrated on the webpage and read underneath the picture, "Taken in 1947, photographer uncredited." The article continued, "This is one of those stories HPUK uncovered a few months back. Don't get us wrong, we've published our fair share of dubious shadow creature reports, but this one isn't without some credible historical ties. The story dates back to 1752 to a group known as the Monks of Medmenham. They were men of carnal pagan beliefs. Debauchery was their primary focus, and human ritual sacrifice was commonplace. The monks were supposedly disbanded by King George II, but spotty reports continued for the next 100 years. The specifics get foggy during that time, but HPUK discovered the monks continued operating in secrecy until World War II. Recently, unclassified documents from the Ministry of Defense reveal a cult of worshippers, now called the Parliament of Shades, had taken up residence in the West Wycombe Caves. See Hellfire Caves. The MOD had considered renovating the caves as bomb shelters against the Nazi blitzkrieg until they found an unspecified amount of mutilated bodies and ritual artifacts belonging to the cult littering the caves. Several cultists captured on scene were interrogated and quietly executed. The remaining cultists promised retribution, performed a powerful retribution ritual, and promptly committed suicide by hanging, one at a time. Here's where it gets dicey. Hellfire Caves opened in 1951, and people have reported the presence of ghosts wandering the caves. Most people witnessed a female ghost, see White Lady of Wycombe, but some visitors claimed black apparitions in dress coats with derby hats appeared and followed them home. Yes, you read that right. Followed them home. Eyewitnesses say the evil spirit stalked unlucky females. Victims eventually lost their bloody minds and turned homicidal. These shades are responsible for over 67 deaths in the past 50 years. The horrible trend isn't on the decline either. More unsuspecting people have been drawn to Hellfire Caves due to the publicity generated by recent ghost-chasing TV shows filming on the property. HPUK encourages everyone to avoid the Hellfire Caves. The Parliament of Shades is no laughing matter. Parliament of Shades. The words fell from her lips. Excuse me? The smartly dressed woman was suddenly beside Emma. Are you feeling okay? Fine, Emma said flatly, realizing the pills were at full strength. She snapped her laptop closed and, with effort, shoved it back into the bag. Emma stared at the woman as she continued to speak, but her words sounded more like an adult in a Peanuts cartoon.
Atone.
The shadow man materialized to the far wall.
Oh, God.
She pushed back from the table, clutching the laptop bag to her chest.
Please, no.
A smartly dressed woman looked at Emma with clinical concern and leaned close to say something. Then her body became rigid as a statue. Her eyes grew wide as if something was trying to push its way out of her eye sockets. Emma watched as the white of the lady's eyes began rupturing in pinpoint red spots. Within seconds, her eyes were completely bloody. Crimson tears ran down her face as she rose off the floor.
Atone.
The deep, cold voice called. A second voice. The other shadow appeared a few feet away from the first shadow. He moved slowly, effortlessly, through tables and furniture as he advanced. The rays of light from the overhead bulbs soaked into him like an animal helplessly submerging into a tar pit. Both moved forward as if they had all the time in the world. The well-dressed woman hovered, her body quivering in unspeakable torment. The muscles were taut to the point of snapping. Her mouth tried to speak, perhaps to scream, but her voice was lost as the rapid motion of her head jerking back and forth began. The sickening sound of her neck snapping, like dry kindling breaking over her knee, filled Emma's ears as she fled the common room.
Atone.
The third shadow ran, appeared in the hallway. He reached for her as she simultaneously recoiled. His shadowy hand gently brushed against her, chilling her to the core. Like a child fearfully hugging its mother, Emma held the computer bag to her chest as she staggered the opposite way down the hall. The only thing at the end of the hall led to the elevator. She smashed the button while keeping a panicked watch on the advancing shadowman.
Bloody hell, she shouted, and slammed the elevator button again and again.
The elevator pinged cheerily as the door swung open. Emma tumbled into the small elevator. She dove for the ground floor button as the chorus of blackness called her name. With shadow men mere feet from the elevator, the clunky door hissed closed. Fighting the effects of the pills mixed with the adrenaline plunge, Emma breathed a small sigh of relief in the hum of the elevator. She looked at her distorted reflection in the shiny chrome button panel and gasped at the pale, gaunt face staring back at her. A halo of flowing white hair wrapped her emaciated profile, and her eyes were blackened pits, and consciousness was a blessing. Emma regained her wits in her dormitory bed, with a worried Claire peering intently.
What's going on?
Emma asked weakly.
I found you passed out in the elevator.
I feel like a fool.
Emma sat up.
Are you okay?
Right as rain, Claire. Emma faked a smile. I won't be taking any more of those pills. Her alarm clock confirmed another 4 hours had been lost. It would take till morning before other residents discovered the body of the smartly dressed woman. Police canvassed the entire dorm while Claire convinced Emma to feign ignorance. Reluctantly, Emma complied, and the police left thinking a serial killer had been born in Arkham. The next few days passed in a paranoid blur. The minimal amount of sleep took a toll on Emma. By the time Saturday came, she looked haggard and felt worse. Emma pulled her auburn hair into a ragged ponytail and dressed warmly for the anthropological field trip to the long-abandoned Werner textile mill outside of town. Claire bounded into the room with a bubbly exuberance.
Ready to get out to this tomb?
Emma nodded weakly and walked to the cramped closet for a coat. When she turned back, Claire stood before her, grinning, holding a small hat box.
"What's this, then?"
asked Emma. "I got you a little something to make you feel better." Claire handed the box to Emma. Emma pulled the lid off and sifted through the pink tissue paper. After a few seconds of hunting, she retrieved a diminutive bell made of brass, or perhaps bronze. It was tubular, 2 inches in height, no more than an inch in diameter. Emma jangled it, and the tone was light and pleasant. However, her waxing nausea told a different story.
Thank you, Claire.
It gets better.
that was made with actual fragments from the original bells of St. Lawrence Church. Yes, the church of your hometown. How awesome is that? Claire was quite pleased with herself. Where did you... Claire cut her off. I have my sources. eBay? Yep. Claire hooked Emma's arm. Let's get going. The 10 anthropology students and their teacher piled into the enormous dark blue passenger van with the university crest emblazoned on the doors. It took about 45 minutes to get to the Werner Textile Mill. Emma stared at the passing landscape of the bony trees, desperately holding the last of their colorful dead leaves. She found cold comfort in the fact that not a single shade lurked behind the barren tree trunks. "Claire, did you bring anything to drink?" Emma asked, and then noticed Claire was catching a quick nap. One of the other Miskatonic explorers piped up. "Brits like tea, right?" said Trevor. "Yes, please." Trevor pulled out a large thermos from his backpack, unscrewed the lid, filled it with a steaming coppery liquid, and passed it to Emma. "Enjoy," he winked and smiled. Emma accepted the vaporous thermos cup and took a small sip. From Trevor's reputation, she half expected the tang of alcohol. She was relieved to discover the bitter taste of oversteeped leaves. "Well, thank you." The Werner Textile Mill had been closed since 1912 after a horrific fire swept through the 2-acre facility. The blaze claimed 82 child laborers, leading to the closure of the mill and forcing its owner, Ludwig Werner, into permanent seclusion. In the 1940s, the town council reduced the teen hangout aspect by bricking up the windows and doors, effectively turning it into a monolithic mausoleum. Professor Maitland had gotten a special dispensation from the township for an anthropological expedition into the 100-year-old facility. It was a unique opportunity to rediscover a place that had captured turn-of-the-century culture covered in forgotten, smoky soot. "Okay," Professor Maitland started. "Group A, manufacturing plant. Group B, employee bivouac. No souvenirs." The students broke into groups of five and marched off to their area of exploration. In the middle of the long walk to the bivouac, Emma felt her vision become strange. The rays of the afternoon sun were more colorful, and the ground itself seemed to lazily ebb and flow. Even the ancient bricks of the mill slightly distorted and warped. "Are you okay, Em?" Claire asked. "I'm feeling odd," Emma managed. "Have you eaten today?" "A cereal bar, Trevor's tea." She waved a hand in front of her face. Motion trails followed the movement. "Wait, Trevor's tea?" Emma offered a confused look at Claire's irritation. "He puts magic mushrooms in his tea. That asshole."
"Atone."
"No, no, no, no." Emma held her ears, but the rumbling voice ignored her pleas. "What the hell is..." Claire abruptly stopped. In the mixture of drugs and disbelief, Emma fell slack-jawed as four shadowmen surrounded the students. The Parliament of Shades, black and sinister, had come in full force. Tears streamed down her face as she helplessly watched her friends rise off the ground. She could not bear to hear the eventual chorus of splintering bones to come. "Damn you cowards," Emma screamed. "Leave them be. Take me already." Now she advanced to the closest shade.
"Atone,"
rumbled the shadow man. He stretched an ebony hand toward Emma's chest as she stared defiantly. The inky digits penetrated her, like a diver breaking the water, as his hand dipped into her torso to the wrist. She could feel the creature's hand clench and start to withdraw from her bosom. There was no blood, pain, or sensation whatsoever. As the shadow pulled back, smoky white tendrils twisted and wrapped around his fist. Emma's chest lurched forward like someone tugging an attached line. The shadow was relentless, like pulling muscles from their shell. Suddenly, a ghostly white figure partially materialized from Emma's body, shrieking and howling. She instantly recognized the white, hazy figure. It had the same face she had seen in the elevator. It hissed and spat at the shadow man, but struggled to no use.
The shadow man wrapped a thick black hand around the neck of the dirty white apparition and continued to extract the phantom from Emma. Emma remembered the bell and removed it from her pocket.
"To hell with a lot of you!"
She desperately began ringing the diminutive object. Like a stone dropped in a still pond, shockwaves billowed from the bell. Both dark and light wailed as ripples of destructive sound knocked them apart and tore at their existence. In a matter of seconds, all apparitions had vanished. Emma watched her friends fall to the ground, alive. Emma staggered around the ruins of the mill, exhausted. Everything became clear as the white lady was ripped away from Emma's soul. It was the vengeful ghost of Suki that had escaped the hellfire caves inside Emma. It was no childhood fantasy. The white lady unleashed her wrath when Emma became inebriated through drugs or alcohol. The Parliament of Shades were protectors, eternally committed to keeping the long-dead chambermaid in check. Would the white lady return? Emma had no idea. In the ruins of a long-abandoned mill, Emma Reardon grasped the fleeting strands of sanity that remained, trying not to succumb to the horror surrounding her. She should have seen the signs. She should have protected her. Claire should have prevented Emma from opening her wrists and letting her life drain away. Claire wiped tears away and took another gulp from the bottle of vodka. She wished she could remember anything that had happened at the mill, but she didn't. Although the police questioned her after she awakened from the shock-induced unconsciousness, all she wanted was the smooth taste of Stoli. Claire prayed her new 90-proof friend would soothe her aching soul.
Atone.
A low, masculine voice rumbled into her ears like a distant peal of thunder. And that, my friends, was Parliament of Shades, written by Jeffrey Ebright. Oh, now that was a story, wasn't it? And the worst part, Emma thought she knew who the real monsters were. She thought the shadows were the ones haunting her. But in the end, it turned out that they weren't her enemies at all. No, they were trying to contain something else, something inside her. Something older, something vengeful. And when she finally understood, it was too late. Maybe that's the real lesson, eh? Sometimes the things we fear the most, the things that haunt the edges of our vision, lurking in the dark, aren't the ones we should be afraid of. Sometimes the real terror is already inside us, waiting for the right moment to take control. Now, don't get too comfortable. We're not done yet. Because our next tale, well, this one's a little different. This one is about a man who grants wishes. Sounds nice, doesn't it? A little wish here, a little wish there. No harm in that. Except, every wish has a cost. And the man who grants them, he makes sure you pay. This is The Wishing Man, written by Jeffrey Ebright. My name is Dalton J. Tucker. Don't ask what the J stands for, because I ain't telling. I'm from a little town called Waverly's Crossing. Spent all 103 years of my life in the Crossing, so I guess that makes me historian by default. That is, until I got too old and they put me in this retirement home to die. That was over 30 years and a bunch of letters I sent to my damn ungrateful children some time ago. I tell you, I'd like to see them walk 3 miles a day and lift weights when they get to my age. But that don't matter. I outlived most of them. Anyway, my great-granddaughter visited me yesterday to shake the cobwebs. That's what I'm talking about, my hometown. You see, Waverly's Crossing is a great place to raise your young'uns and live a nice, peaceful life. Everybody knows everybody there, and ain't no scandals that ain't kept between fences. I was sure we're nosy, but we don't stick the nose in. We just wave it about to smell what we can smell. But there was a time when the crossing was a fearful place. A place where the bravest man hid in his cellar when night came a-calling. Where no man nor beast didn't go to sleep with a prayer in his lips after the wishing man came to Waverly's crossing. He called himself F.S. Krug, but nobody wanted to know what the F or S stood for. They just satisfied themselves with Mr. Krug. And that was that. From what the backyard magpies heard, he was single, about 40, and last hung his hat in Cleveland. I overheard Mavis Simpson talking to my mama and telling her that nothing good ever came from Cleveland. Of course, being in my 10th year, I always thought Mavis Simpson was half honey and half vinegar. The honey half was so she could trap her victim for smothering it with the vinegar half. Though the fact Mr. Krug came from the big city did bring a mite bit of awe to my eyes. At that age, the big city was a tale taller than any my grandpappy could tell after a few snorts of shine. So when Mr. Krug bought the old Tate feed store, I was the first to stick my face into the display window to see what I could see. It took Mr. Krug 2 days before his shop opened. Most folks guessed it'd be either a hardware store, Lord knows we needed one, or a wholesale purchasing store for farmers to sell their corn and wheat and such. We were all wrong. The hand-painted sign he hung out in front said, "The Order Store, F.S. Krug Proprietor." Good trick, I thought, because it made you go in to find out what he was selling. Turns out he was a processor for the Spiegel Catalog, arranging orders for the Spiegel Catalog Company, so they went to the proper place for filling. There's also a rumor that he did spot checks on deliveries to make sure the right thing was going to the right place. He weren't dumb, neither. He kept a few floor models and catalogs around so as the public could buy or order something that tickled their fancy. Mr. Krug also kept some hardware supplies, feed grain, and penny candy about to please anybody stomping by. Since the stock market hadn't yet crashed, his business boomed. Seemed like Mama'd send me to Mr. Krug's store every 3 days or so for this or that she'd plumb forgot about needing. Every time I'd walk into the order store, it kind of made me sick to my stomach. The place smelled like there was dead mouse rotting in a forgotten trap. That, with the smell of raw grain, tractor oil, and some fancy French perfume nobody bought, made my tummy a mite bit on the queasy side. I'd get Mama's list done real fast so as I could get away from the stink and from Mr. Krug. I guess it was the way he'd look at you with those brown dark eyes enough to snuff a street lamp. Or maybe it was that skinny body of his and how it looked all gnarled up, but moved like one of those alley cats chasing after a late-night snack. I reckon even his toothy grin set me back, sort of like a smile a clown paints on. Whatever it was, I didn't want to stay around to find out what got my gander up. Though I did notice a queer sign he put on the counter that said, "Special needs, the store hours may be extended upon request." Never had the gumption to ask what that meant either. And whether the whole town knew or not, what started happening a month after the wishing man came to the crossing was all because of those special needs and extended hours. I found out later that Jed Robinson was the first to see the wishing man. I heard that story from Mavis, the gossip telling Mama, as I acted like I was eating my eggs one early morning. Jed was the kind of guy that bad luck was his only luck. His wife run off with a lightning rod peddler a year before, and he seemed to kill anything that had a motor with a touch of his hand. Well, the wishing man told Jed he could grant him what his heart wanted if he came back after hours. Jed did. He made the wish to be wanted by women without having all his bad luck with the mechanical stuff. and for the whole of next week, Jed Robinson was the town lady killer, having a different woman on his arm every night. He also found he could fix anything from tractors to wind-up toy cars. Never saw a man turn his life around so fast. After Jed's perfect week, it happened. He was playing bingo at the church with Sally Trago when his first conquest, Bessie Mayfield, burst into the hall all wild-eyed and screaming at the top of her lungs. Bessie was yelling about how Jed could do this to her and with a harlot like Sally. Sally, not the kind to sit back and take such talk, balled up her fists and told Bessie it was time to discuss the matter out back. But Bessie kept advancing with a crazy look to her. Jed, trying to avoid a messy spot, stepped between the two. Little did he know, Bessie came to settle the score with her daddy's bowie knife. And she did, stabbing Jed in the chest and killing him dead right there in the bingo hall. But it were no fluke. There was more misery to come, compliments of the wishing man. Old man Griffin wished next. I'd never known a greedier man in my life than Elias Griffin, but no amount of money was enough for him. He wished for $1 million and got it 3 days later. Old man Griffin, cheap as he was, didn't want to pay me and my brother, Jack, a nickel to clean out his coal cellar, so he did it himself. It was halfway done before the ceiling came down on him. The ceiling fell in because there was gold bars hidden by some crooks back around 1890 in the crawl space. Those gold bars crushed the old skinflint's head in, but not before he knew what had killed him. Police Chief Maxwell was told by the G-men who took the gold that there was about $1 million in pure gold. Old man Griffin died a millionaire, at least. Despite the run of bad luck and hazard it carried, a lot of people heard about the wishes Mr. Krug offered and came late in the night to have their dreams made real. Mary Beth Willis wished to have another baby, even though Doc Walters said her seeds weren't worth the water to plant. 9 months down the road, Mary Beth died giving birth to a retarded baby girl. Sam Bettis wished for a new tractor to harvest his crops. Sam got an inheritance from his uncle he didn't know he had and bought the most expensive tractor the tractor factory'd send him. 2 weeks later, Sam left the tractor running and began refueling when he spilled gas in the hot engine. Needless to say, Sam Bettis burned alive. Kerry Washington just wished for a new wedding band to replace the one she'd lost in the well. She got a new one, all right, and a case of metal poisoning from the ring. Since she flat-out refused Doc Walters' suggestion she take the cursed thing off, Kerry withered away, dying in pain no being should ever suffer. But more and more people ignored the curse, plain as the nose on your face, and kept their appointments with F.S. Krug. All told, 17 men, women, and children passed away that year. All of them visited the Wishing Man. Come to think of it, it was my brother Jack who started calling him the Wishing Man. The other kids in the crossing picked up on it that summer, and by the time fall came around, even the older town folks secretly called him the Wishing Man. It was in that cool time of year when me and Jack decided to play Junior G-Men and find out just what the heck Mr. Krug was up to. Me and Jack finished dinner and yawned a couple fierce yawns and told Mama and Pop we was going to bed early. Mama was deep into the scriptures and Pop was deep into the cups of shine by the time me and Jack got up the nerve to escape out our bedroom window. We shimmied down the oak tree, made our way to the order store. We both felt like it was one of Elliot Ness's untouchables as we creeped from house to edge and searched at the crossings of Al Capone. The light from the gas street lamps made Main Street look spooky, casting wavy shadows here and there. I could feel Jack shaking like Pop's old blue tick when it was in heat. Patted him on the back, told him to stop acting like a little girl, and led him to the Wishing Man's store by the arm. storefront was black as pitch. But I'd heard tell Mr. Watkins was going to make him a wish tonight. So I told Jack to watch the front while I checked out the back. There were no windows in the back of the store, but there was a rear door where you'd throw your garbage so as not to stink up the store. The door was cracked open a mite bit, and I could see there was a faint light inside, like how a candle or an oil lamp would shine. Being an untouchable, I peeked in to see what I could see. The light was coming from upstairs, and there was voices talking. Krug and Watkins, for sure. I figured a good G-man would check out the hideout for any incriminating evidence, so I snuck inside to poke my nose about. Weren't nothing to find, though. There was order forms and boxes postmarked from Chicago, and debtor letters and cleaning stuff and the like. Just when I began thinking maybe bad luck was just taking a vacation here in the crossing, the light and voices came down the stairs. I scampered to find me a hiding place, scared to the bone and needing an outhouse worse than ever in my life. The footsteps seemed almost next to me as I jumped into the pantry and held my breath behind the closed door. The fear in my mind made the voices of Mr. Krug and Mr. Watkins sound like they was speaking some strange language, one I'm sure as heck couldn't figure. It was then that I saw the other light. It was a low light shining between the slats of the wall that had mason jars of preserves and green beans on the shelves. As quiet as I could, I moved over to the wall with the light behind and tried to look through the slats. You could imagine my surprise when the wall opened up from my leaning against it. The wall was like one of those secret doors that shine runners would put in to fool the police and keep their still safe. It was built with a pivot in the middle to open easier and quieter, which I did. My mouth dropped open when I saw what the wishing man hid in his bootlegger's hole. Shelves were all around the little room, and all those shelves had lots of mason jars, just a-cluttering up every shelf. Now here's what put the fear of God into me. The light was coming from about a dozen of those jars. These jars looked like they'd been pressured and sealed, and the light inside was hard to explain. Best I can compare it to is when I was in Alaska and saw the Aurora Borealis. Each mason jar looked like it had been scooped from the aurora. The light inside swirled all kinds of colors, with never the same way of doing things. Each of the aurora jars had cannon labels on them, too. I almost soiled myself when I read them. Every one of them said something different, but all were just as terrifying as the next. Jed Robinson said one label. Kerry Washburn read another. Elias Griffin. Sam Bettis. Mary Beth Williams. And other names were on them labels. I knew all of them, and all of them were dead. And all of them been rumored to wish, too. Had enough scary stuff for the night, so I decided to get out of there. I shut the secret door, and the hairs in the back of my neck stood on end. Then I heard the footsteps again. Scareder than a polecat in a dog kennel, I looked for anywhere to hide. I saw some grain sacks against the wall and made my move. I burrowed under those 50-pound sacks, getting my feet up under as the door opened, and the wishing man walked in, humming some god-awful opera tune. I took a few breaths as I could while he whistled in the bootlegger hole. By the sound of it, he was doing something with the mason jars. My curiosity made me peek my head out to see what was going on. I knew I didn't want to, you know, but I knew I had to know. There was a wishing man humming and taking stock of those filled mason jars, and he eyed them pretty good. In that brown undertaker suit of his, he shuffled his feet like he was needing to visit the outhouse. When he stopped shuffling, I saw the jar with the Elias Griffin label in his hand being unscrewed. The jar opened with a pop, and the wishing man smiled. I don't really understand what exactly happened next, but I do have an opinion. Those colorful lights in the jar, which I believe to be the soul of the name on the jar, rolled out that mason jar like bottled smoke.
The wishing man took a big drag off that smoke like a banker toking a Havana mild. His eyes seemed to twinkle more and more as he inhaled more and more of the light in the jar like he was drinking the soul of poor old man Griffin. There's also another thing I won't forget. I could have sworn I heard Elias Griffin moaning in pain all the while the wishing man was a-snorting that light. And the damnedest silence came after he was done draining that mason jar. The wishing man put the half-drained jar back on the shelf, sitting it next to the other glowing mason jars at his disposal. To this day, I don't know how the soul drinking worked. I just knew I didn't want nothing to do with it right then and there. Mr. Krug left shortly after his dinner, but I waited a couple more minutes before I made my escape. As I was sneaking out the door I came in, I could hear the wishing man talking. Not to himself, though. I stopped for a second to listen, and glad I did. The voice that answered was my brother Jack's. I didn't know what to do, so I waited till they went upstairs before I made my move. I ran back to the bootlegger hole and grabbed up as many of those mason jars as I could. Being only 10 years old, I held 4 jars safely. The ones left over I hid beneath the grain sacks. That done, I mustered my courage and headed them up the narrow stairs to where the wishing man took my little brother. The wishing man was talking up a storm by the time I found the room he took Jack to. The door was part open, so I watched what he was doing and saying. He said, "You can wish for whatever your heart desires, Jack. Anything, my dear boy, anything. The only rule is you may not wish for anything on a world scale." "Why?" Jack asked. "Because the world's too big for one little boy to have such control. Just think your wish and blow out the candle. That's all you need to do." Jack looked kind of scared when Mr. Krug lit that weird black candle and it spit sparks to the flame. The smell was none too nice, neither. It was that rotten, ratten, the trap smell I'd smelled in the bootlegger hole. The wishing man picked up the candlestick that queer candle was in and set it in front of Jack. I could tell Jack's curious nature had got the best of him. Jack cocked his head, looked at the wishing man, then closed his eyes for that evil candle and drew a big breath. "No, Jack," I yelled, running in. I took both of them by surprise, so much so they stared at me like a sideshow freak. Then the wishing man says, "Hello, Dalton. I was wondering when you would join our party. It's your lucky day today, too." With that, he pulled another black candle from his suit jacket. I says, "No, thanks. I just came to get my brother. Come on, Jack." For I knew he lit that other candle and was offering it to me with the biggest smile. "Go ahead, Dalton. Wish for yourself, or even your mother or father. It's your wish, take it." I swear I never had to pee so bad in my whole life as I did that dark night, but I knew I had to do something besides wet myself. So I says, "Sure, but since I'm older, I get to go first." The wishing man's smile got bigger and says, "Well, certainly, Dalton." I took a quick look at Jack. He looked like one off them cobras under the spell of a snake charmer. Gathered myself, thought my wish, and blew out the candle. The wishing man had victory written all over him, but only for a second. "Is it warm in here?" the wishing man says, loosening his tie. He was instantly sweating a river, and that smug look was replaced by a confused one. When he started to smoke, confusion turned to fear. In the blink of an eye, the wishing man caught fire. The flames covered him as quick as flies to dung, and he could only scream as the flames got brighter and wider. The wishing man staggered round the room, insane with pain and not dying, despite his screams. It was then the floorboard split beneath his feet. Pairs of red clawed hands grabbed onto his pants and started dragging Mr. Krug into the floor. Jack buried his head in my jacket, but I watched as the burning wishing man was dragged into the hole where those evil hands came from. It felt like I was watching someone drown,
'cause the last I saw of the wishing man was his flaming hand go down as the floorboards put themselves back together and sealed up the magic hole. Then Jack says to me, "What happened?" I says, "I just wished him to burn in hell, Jack." Then I hugged him tighter. Before we left, Jack says to me, "What about my wish?" I says, "No, Jack, it's too dangerous. I just wish I don't have to see him till Jesus come to take me." Then I pinched out the flame on Jack's wish candle and broke it in half. When I did that, one of those mason jars I was holding in my jacket fell out and broke. The light inside was like kerosene, setting the floor ablaze. Needless to say, me and Jack hightailed it back home and watched the order store burn down from our bedroom window. Waverly's Crossing returned to the peaceful life soon after the embers cooled from the fire. Chief Maxwell, since there was no body, proclaimed it a mystery and happily filed the whole matter away. Besides the tragic death of Mr. Watkins, a couple of weeks later, he got gored by his champion stud bull. I always wondered what he'd wished for. People died naturally after Mr. Krug disappeared. And me? Well, I've lived a pretty regular life between the bad dreams of the wishing man. But I think I got a while before I touched the robe of God. I dream about the wishing man more and more. In my dreams, he says he's coming back 'cause of the wish. No, not the wish I made on my candle, but the wish I made on Jack's candle. My second wish was to not see him till I die. It's a wish I never thought I'd made, and one I wished I hadn't. But I got myself an ace. I kept those mason jars with those stolen souls in them. That's how I beat cancer 20 years back, and how I survived a triple bypass at age 92. Don't know if that was the Christian thing to do with them jars, but I do know I got one jar left, and I'm damned if I'm going to see the wishing man in the flesh till my last ace is long past played. I guess that's why I'm telling you this story, 'cause when the wishing man comes back, ain't no 17 lives going to be lost, and ain't no 10-year-old going to stop him. When he comes, his determination will be forged in a century of hellfire and revenge. He'll be worse than any war, 'cause he'll cover death in the sweetest sugar, and people will step over one another to get a taste. I just pray to God I never die, 'cause this world needs an acre more hope to grow a couple more bushels of love. And it don't look too good for anybody nowadays. Well, anybody, except the wishing man." And that was The Wishing Man, written by Jeffrey E. Bright. That's the funny thing about wishes, isn't it? We always think we know what we want. We convince ourselves that if we just had this one thing, everything would be better. But what if the wish isn't the problem? What if it's the one granting it? F.S. Krug made a lot of promises, and folks lined up to take him at his word. But every single one of them learned the truth too late. Because a wish isn't a gift, it's a trade. And the wishing man, he always got the better end of the deal. Oh, yeah. So, if you ever find yourself wandering down a street you don't remember, past a shop that wasn't there yesterday, and the man behind the counter asks what your heart desires, maybe keep your mouth shut, because the price of a wish isn't always in dollars, and once you've paid, there ain't no refunds. So, there you have it, my dear little campers. Two stories, two warnings. One about the things that watch from the dark, waiting for us to make a mistake. And one about the things that offer us exactly what we want, knowing it will be the last thing we ever truly own. And now, as always, I leave it to you. Maybe these stories are just stories. Maybe they're just old legends passed down and twisted over time. But then again, Maybe there's more truth to them than we'd like to believe. It's up to you to decide. Sleep tight, my friends, and if you hear a whisper in the dark, best not to answer.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.